Can anyone get the economy moving in Japan? From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update for December 17th. I'm Jeff Horwich. We'll talk election implications in Japan, a giant bill for Superstorm Sandy recovery here in the U.S., and the lessons both sides in the fiscal cliff talks might take away from that time so many years ago when the Bush tax cuts were passed in the first place.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Over the weekend, Japan elected a new prime minister, and today Shinzo Abe laid out his economic plans in a press conference. Japan's got a huge budget deficit, along with another problem much less familiar to us here in the U.S. Over here, we fret about every glimmer of inflation. In Japan, they might love a little inflation right now. Deflation has been the norm for so long, many young Japanese don't remember anything else. Margarita Estevez Abe, no relation to the next Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, is a Japan expert and a professor of political science at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Characterize for us what it's like in Japan to live under prolonged deflation, because Americans don't know much about that.
Okay, so let me tell you from my personal experience.
Uh-huh.
I'm originally from Japan. I grew up in Japan. And when I was a college student in Japan, this is just almost 20 years ago, when I go back to Japan now, the prices are the same or even cheaper. So this should just give you a sense of what deflation is, because anywhere in the U.S., if you compare today's prices with what the prices used to be 20 years ago, you will see a significant increase.
At first blush, people might say, well, that doesn't sound so bad. So what's the problem?
Well, it just basically means that the economy has been contracting. So this is not good news. Well, of course, you don't want a huge sort of inflation. But deflation means that your economy is not doing much. It's just not adding jobs. People are not spending. So, in a sense, what Japan has been experiencing has been this continuous contraction of the national economy.
Can Shinzo Abe, in all of this Herculean task of getting the Japanese economy moving again, can he succeed where who knows how many prime ministers have failed before him?
Right. There are certain things that are going for him. The market seems to like him in the sense that the yen has gotten weaker, and immediately that has just led to a boost to the Japanese stock market. He'll probably just spend a lot in terms of public work spending. So this is just going to lift the economy as well, because construction industry and all the related industries will just benefit from this. He hasn't said that he's committed to increasing taxes. And everyone knows that he's very pro-nuclear industry. So all these things in the short run would really help the Japanese economy. Basically, what this is going to do is boost the domestic demand, and also will improve Japan's trade balance. But this is short-term sort of projection.
Margarita Estevez Abe is a political scientist at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And let's check the numbers. A concrete fiscal cliff offer on tax hikes from Republicans could be a good chunk of what's buoying stocks so far this morning. At least the Dow is up at this hour about 0.7%. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ both closing in on 1% higher on the day. So could be a decent day, but who knows what the afternoon may hold. We closed last week with some strong data for U.S. manufacturing. Today, a bit more of a bummer. A report from the New York Federal Reserve that factory activity is declining in New York State. To talk through today's data, now I've got Gus Fauché. He's senior economist at the PNC Financial Services Group. Hey, Gus.
Morning, Jeff.
So people keep an eye on this Empire State Manufacturing Index, and it does look a little gloomy. What's your take?
Well, the big news is there's a drop in inventories for the month. Inventories were a big support to growth in the third quarter. I think, you know, probably producers have a little too much stock on hand, so I think inventories are going to be a drag for growth in the fourth quarter, and this is consistent with that.
Let's talk about something else on our plates today, another data point. We have a survey from the National Association for Business Economics. So what does this collection of economic forecasters think that we here in the U.S. have coming?
They think that the recovery is going to continue, but that growth is going to remain moderate. So they're expecting the economy to expand by a little bit more than 2% in 2013. The labor market recovery is going to continue with job gains of around 150,000-160,000 per month or so, and that means that the unemployment rate is going to fall, but it's still going to remain uncomfortably high.
So what kind of stock do you place in it when someone like this NABE, National Association for Business Economics, gives us a look at what's ahead?
Well, you know, I think this is consistent with what we're seeing overall. We have an improving housing market that's a support to growth. The consumers are spending a little bit more. But on the other hand, in 2013, we're going to have a drag from likely tax increases and spending cuts. And business investment growth is slowing. So I would expect to see that moderate growth that the NABE is talking about.
Gus Fauché, senior economist at the PNC Financial Services Group. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
The airline, famous for its bags fly free policy, is having to rethink its unusually generous approach to fees. Southwest Airlines has announced plans to increase fees across its flights. The changes will also apply to AirTran, which Southwest bought in 2010. Here's Marketplace's David Weinberg.
In 2011, the airline industry collected about $8 billion in ancillary fees, what you pay to check bags, order food, pick your seat, things other than the cost of the fare.
The profit of the entire industry in that year was less than half that.
Samuel Engel is a vice president at the airline consulting firm ICF International.
Southwest publicly made a decision not to follow along with the rest of the industry.
That decision helped Southwest keep marketing itself as a discount airline. But according to Michael J. Boyd of the Boyd Group, Southwest hasn't been a low-cost carrier for 5 years.
To their credit, they're not a low-cost carrier because they pay their people decently. So they have to dance around issues, and fees are going to be one of those issues they're going to have to start striking up the orchestra and dancing with.
Southwest will increase fees for third bags and overweight baggage, and they'll institute a new no-show fee for passengers who miss their flight. The company expects the fee changes to increase revenue by at least $100 million next year. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Today, the Senate takes up a $60 billion bill to boost recovery efforts from Superstorm Sandy. Many places are still working to get back on their feet. In Hoboken, New Jersey, for example, a crucial train station won't be operating again for weeks, and the transit crisis is strangling local businesses, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
Passengers scurry down the ramp to catch the ferry. With the PATH train station closed, this is the only direct route across the Hudson River to Manhattan. Other options require time-consuming transfers. But direct service has its price, and it's eating into Tara Weston's budget.
It's ridiculous. I'm spending like $11 one way.
That's a jump of up to $8.50 more than she used to pay. Plus, it takes half an hour longer, and the extra time getting back home turns out to be a problem for stores over on Hoboken's main drag, Washington Street. Dear Hannah is a women's clothing boutique there. Owner Hannah Callier says drawn-out commutes are stifling her customers.
When they do get back home in the evenings, they're worn out, and it's just too late to shop.
And forget about any shoppers from Manhattan, which is normally just 8 minutes away on the train. Elsewhere on Washington Street, the door sign on gift shop Greetings from Hoboken pleads shop local, help rebuild Hoboken. Jeff Spinardi owns it with his wife. He says Hanukkah was a total bust. Sales are down more than a third from this time last year, the crucial holiday shopping season.
This is really a do or die for a lot of small businesses in Hoboken.
He's hoping any aid from Washington, D.C. reaches shopkeepers on Washington Street.
When you rely on foot traffic and you have none, it's like, fellas, can you do anything?
City Hall is also on Washington Street. Hoboken Mayor Don Zimmer testified in the Senate last week about helping a city with an estimated $100 million in storm damage.
Funds are really needed. It's very difficult for individuals and for businesses right now.
She's fighting for grants to businesses and funding for transit repair, among other things. Help can't come soon enough. Washington Street didn't flood in the storm, but the resulting transportation mess has stores there underwater. In Hoboken, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The latest this morning from the fiscal cliff talks might yield a breakthrough or a blip. We've certainly seen hopes for compromise rise and fall before. House Speaker John Boehner has proposed letting the Bush tax cuts expire for millionaires. That is considerably higher than the president's notion to raise taxes on everyone making more than $250,000 a year, but it does open up a space for negotiations. The process of pushing through those Bush tax cuts 12 years ago might seem like ancient history, but we could stand to go back in time and learn a little something from it. That, at least, is the advice of Fortune magazine's senior editor-at-large, Alan Sloan. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Jeff.
So take us back to the political context in which the Bush tax cuts were passed. In hindsight, what's the lesson that we might take from the Republican experience then?
The lesson we ought to take is what seems brilliant and innovative today could come back and bite you on some vulnerable part of your anatomy a few years down the road. And that's what's happening with the Bush tax cuts because of the way the Bush people pushed them through. What happened was rather than compromise with the Democrats and get a permanent tax cut, the Bush people pushed through something called a reconciliation, which had to expire at the end of 2010. And there's no question, at least to me, that the high-income people are going to end up with higher taxes now than they would have had the Bush people made a deal anywhere along the line or had, during the Obama years, had the Republicans made a deal.
And so here we are in 2012 going through all this again. And so to the Republicans now, I guess you might say, remember that overreach.
Right. But you now hear Republicans saying that, well, we'll just let everything expire. We won't give the Democrats anything. And then we'll hold the debt ceiling hostage in early 2013 and have more bargaining power.
Now to the Democrats, are there areas where you're concerned that they might be risking their own overreach?
Yeah, I happen to be a big fan of Social Security for a variety of reasons. And one of the things I know about Social Security, because I've studied it so much, is that it cannot continue indefinitely the way it is because it's not sustainable. But you hear Democrats saying, at least in public, that there's no need to do anything with Social Security because it's showing a surplus for budget purposes. So if the Democrats don't cut a deal to save Social Security long term with relatively moderate things now, you could see where in 10 years Social Security's finances are going to be really bad. And what's happening to the Republicans with tax cuts now could happen to the Democrats with Social Security in 2020. I really hope they get their show together and fix it by trimming benefits to the likes of me, who are the high-income people, rather than pretending there isn't a problem.
Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large at Fortune Magazine, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeff.
The nation's number three wireless carrier, Sprint, is in the process of a takeover by a Japanese company called SoftBank. It's not clear how Sprint might change or whether it can be a stronger competitor under new ownership, but we can get one glimpse of Sprint's future from its own takeover announced today of a company called Clearwire. From our technology desk, here's Marketplace's Queenie Kim.
To compete with AT&T and Verizon, which have about 70% of the market, Sprint needs more spectrum, and Clearwire has it. That spectrum allows Sprint to deliver more data faster. Jeff Kagan is a wireless industry analyst.
SoftBank wants Sprint to acquire Clearwire to get a hold of all the spectrum that they can because they want to transform the wireless industry.
But just what that transformation is going to look like is uncertain. Clearwire only offers data services. It was one of the first companies to offer a high-speed wireless internet connection. And Kagan says that might give us a glimpse of where Sprint is headed.
You have to remember the wireless industry has changed dramatically. More than 5 years ago, it was basically a voice industry, and we used wireless data just a little bit.
Kagan says talking on the phone rates as the fourth or fifth reason people use smartphones. And he adds, Sprint's acquisition of Clearwire could signal that the company will now focus on offering expanded data plans to become more competitive. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
And that will do it for today's Marketplace Midday Update podcast. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.